accession number 19670, Reel 2.
Philip Daniel, Reel 2.
Yes, I say there were eight of us, if I remember correctly, two captains, six lieutenants. And most of the lieutenants were fairly newly commissioned. They'd not served very long in the United Kingdom. So they were fairly raw in that sense, and very nice chaps. Never saw any of them again, of course. Then I was expecting to go to an Indian Army base to train Indian Army anti-aircraft gunners. That had been the kind of implication of the Army Council order in India, which I'd responded to, you know, when the war with Japan broke out. I wanted to see the world, and I thought, you know, we were going to hang around in England for a long time before we got to grips with the Germans, and it was the adventure that I'd looking for. So, but I was a bit disappointed when I got a posting, and the posting was not to the Indian Army, but to a British unit in India. Of course, there's no way of querying this. It simply said, Captain Daniel to 69th Light Anti-Aircraft Regiment at a place called, if I remember correctly, Gauhati, Gauhati, in Assam. And I was told simply to pack my bags. And you did it yourself in India. You didn't... they were still working on the peacetime system. So it wasn't a question of, as it were, my being taken. I simply was told to go and get a railway warrant and draw money for my journey. And I drew a considerable sum of money, I seem to remember, a pound of advice, and a railway warrant, which was, of course, first class, and was told, well, I would simply make my own way from Mau, which is in central India, to Gauhati, which was in Assam, more or less left it to me how it was done. So there I went off and went to people like railway transport officers at main stations and asked, you know, about the next stage. So it was quite a long journey. Took about 12 days because when I got to Calcutta, I found I couldn't immediately, as it were, transfer from one railway to another and go off. I had to wait until, you know, there was a suitable first-class accommodation available for me to use it. So I had 5 or 6 days in Calcutta, and I stayed, naturally, as all officers did, at one of the great hotels, namely the Grand, the Calcutta Grand. I don't think I'd ever stayed in a hotel quite as grand as that in my life before. But I was there right in the middle of the famine, and my recollections of Calcutta mixed with the Grand Hotel, with seeing the Bing Crosby film about the White Christmas in terrible heat, but the cinema was air-conditioned, and a dead cow, which nobody would remove because it was on an awkward position on the tram track, and it seemed to be there a devil of a long time before anybody moved it, by which time it was very fly-blown, and then dead people. And there were quite a lot of dead people on the streets in Calcutta. And this was starvation. And this was very puzzling to a young officer from England. Why should this happen? And I made some inquiries, you know, why are people dying on the streets? And I was told it was the famine. And it was largely because these were rice-eating people. And the famine was particularly affecting due to the rice crop failing. And these people didn't like eating or felt they were unable to eat things which were based on maize rather than rice. Whether that was true or not, I don't know. But it did. The poverty of Calcutta, I think, in large places, the conditions of many people, that sort of thing struck me as very strange and disturbing.
Did anybody seem to be doing anything about it?
Well, I'm sure they were. I can't be sure now why I knew, but I'm sure they were. And I'm sure there were people who were explaining it because being, you know, fairly intelligent, knowledgeable young chap, I got into contact with, say, Roman Catholic friends, priests and so on, whose names I knew because they'd been in England some time and were there, serving in Calcutta, and asked about the general conditions. I did ask about the general conditions. They did explain it wasn't simply indifference on the part of the authorities. It was, there were problems that people were coming in from the countryside in large numbers because of that, those conditions which had led to that famine at that time, and it wasn't immediately easy to provide for them because of dietary rules and the various religious kind of differences which led to these enormous distinctions in a place as complicated socially as India was. But I did also, I started reading the local papers and was aware that there was also the undercurrent of anti-British feeling from some sectors of the population, pro-Japanese feeling and that sort of thing. I mean, various types of resistance to the war were manifesting themselves and causing a certain amount of problems, and clearly for the army authorities in prosecuting the war at the same time. It was clearly there was discontent. I don't mean widespread discontent. There was some unhappiness, and certainly soldiers were not encouraged to go to certain parts of Calcutta, just to have a look-see. They might have found themselves in difficulties.
Which parts of Calcutta were banned?
Well, simply, I'm going to say which parts. It's a huge, sprawling city. I mean, obviously, most of the British soldiers and the white soldiers didn't stray all that far from the main parts of the city which tourists would have gone to in peacetime. They were fairly well defined. I mean, there were huge suburbs which were clearly almost entirely populated by Indians. But there was, an efficient tram system and so on. Somebody might have just got on a tram and wander, just have a look. But on the whole, I think British soldiers not terribly enterprising. It was so damned hot anyway. All they were looking for was possibly somewhere where they'd go and have a swim, and if they were off duty, and have a bit of a pleasant afternoon. I wasn't there long enough at that stage to take it in. I was really sort of having to go get in touch with a railway transport officer to see when I could get up country. So the 5 or 6 days afterwards, I was aware of sort of some very uncomfortable things. Even the Grand Hotel had unfortunate things like bugs in it. I'd never come across that before. Bugs, the old-fashioned bug. There were bugs in your mosquito net if you weren't careful. They got in the wood supporting the structure of the mosquito net, and you didn't expect that in a first-class hotel. Maybe. But I realized that there were forms of life in India which may obtruded themselves on your consciousness. I can remember, waking up in the night and scratching, and then realizing that why I was scratching because of a bug on me. It's not a thing I'd ever directly encountered in before, even in poverty-stricken Britain around where I lived. I'd heard about them, but I'd not seen them before. So there.
Did you see any evidence of civil disturbance in India?
Well, there wasn't widespread civil disturbance, but I mean, I read a thing, I think it was The Statesman, which was the daily paper, the Calcutta daily paper in English, and there would be references to, and of course there were instances, as you know, British officers being killed on isolated railway stations and so on. I was aware that there was some unhappiness in India about the war and some support for the Japanese, and of course that there was indeed a thing called the Indian National Army being formed by a man called Subhas Chandra Bose under Japanese rule in Burma.
Did any Indians speak to you about the political situation?
No, not really then. I didn't know any Indians then, and I was, it was a fairly well cocooned into a sort of British setting in the Grand Hotel. The only Indians one spoke to were the servants, of course. Hotel servants were extremely polite.
Can you tell me about your journey to Guwahati, please?
Well, Guwahati was the, if I remember, the Bengal Assam Railway. I just remember it as sort of what I'd now become used to. I mean, the type of first class carriage on the railway, occupied by the Bara Saabs, in other words, the high ups. I mean, the Bengal Assam Railway was not the most advanced of the Indian railways, so I seem to remember the first class carriages were not quite as posh as they had been on the railway from Bombay to Calcutta, which is a very main line. But we had the usual thing. You've got a big tub of ice put in to cool you down. You got out at particular stations to eat, and the train waited while you ate, and it waited for the convenience of the first class rather than anybody else. Eventually we got to Guwahati, and then there was a river journey, I remember, on a ferry, with great big, you know, like a Mississippi ferry with great big paddle wheels. And then we eventually got on the other side. Forgive me, I can't remember if Pandu's on one side and Guwahati's on the other. But there was, this was a sort of railway ferry. I think if Guwahati's on the Assam side and Pandu's on the Bengal side, well, I might be wrong. But anyway, we had to go across. And I stopped there because that's where I had been ordered to report. And I reported to a railway transport officer there, who then said, oh, well, your unit's just down the road, and eventually a truck came along for me, and I was taken to a battery headquarters of the 69th Light Anti-Aircraft Regiment, and said, here I am, which, of course, they said they'd never heard of me, which was normal. I mean, the movement order hadn't caught up with them. It might have been with the regimental headquarters, which was somewhere else, and so I found myself in this battery, the number of which I regret I forget. I can't remember. I didn't stay all that long. And I don't recall what the battery was called. But I can't even recall the name of the major who received me, who was the battery commander. But he must have been quite a pleasant chap. And I found that because it was a static and not a mobile battery, I was one of two captains. I wasn't a troop commander. I would be the Q captain, in other words, the chap who looked after the anything apart from the operational side of the battery, you know, in charge of the administration, really, and the quartermaster's side of the house, rather than in charge of the operational side of the house. And that was my job for the next 3 months. But I didn't stay at Guwahati. I started immediately moving around largely by air and largely American aircraft between the various bits of the battery which were scattered throughout at northern Assam, as far east as, or northeast as, a place called Lido, L-E-D-O, which was the end of the of the road which went to China, this period was now so confusing I couldn't easily separate out what went on, but largely because I was did Q work, the quartermaster's administrative side, I always seemed to be perpetually moving from one place to another, often with a bag of money, because believe it or not, in those days, you still paid your troops on payday out of a bag of money. I was very often the paying out officer in the very old-fashioned style, sitting at a chair and the chap coming up, and you handed him his appropriate number of rupees, and he smartly saluted and signed for 100 rupees or whatever he was drawing. Probably not as much as 100. Well, it could have been. 13 rupees to the pound, I seem to remember, was more or less the exchange rate. And this was the sort of job I did for something like 3 months. We had a very strange setup. The chaps were round off as hell. They'd been there for a long time, it seemed to them. We'd occasionally seen the Japanese Air Force, but not much of it. So they occasionally fired their gun, but largely they were in most unattractive places around railway junctions, on that extended line of communication, which depended almost entirely on very poor roads, and this meter gauge railway, which ran up from the river to Lido, as far as I remember, and of course was a main objective of the Japanese 2 years later when they tried to get into India to sever that railway. I did all sorts of interesting things. I mean, I drove an engine one time because the engine driver asked me to. I was on supervising moving something or other up the railway, and so he asked me to come up on the footplate, and then he asked me to sign a chit saying he was a good engine driver. So I said, but you should be signing a chit saying I'm a good engine driver. But basically it was rather static, terribly hot. The disease rate was appalling, and by disease I mean malaria and other tropical diseases which were taking their toll. The chaps had been there a long time, it seemed to me, them. They were really very despondent because it was also boring. And although it was interesting for me, it was clearly morale was not high. These were the days before Mountbatten. There was a sort of general belief that the Japanese were pretty invincible and would come roaring over the hills any moment in large numbers and they would all be swept away. It was not a happy time at all. I do remember a couple of things, really, about that period. I can't place them. Or three things, shall we say. I remember getting very friendly with the American Air Force because we were encouraged to, and being persuaded to fly with them. And we were encouraged to. And I flew in an American Dakota to Kunming in China. To get acquainted, and that was a very hairy journey over the Himalayas with a very nasty thunderstorm on the way back when we were carrying a coffin. The coffin had an American nurse in who died in Kunming and accompanied by an American Army nonconformist chaplain who was drunk as could be. And I don't know how much of this should be said. I'm smoked, and the smell of the aircraft, since it had been used to take petrol to China, was such that I was terrified, quite honestly, the whole journey back, because I thought he's going to throw the cigarette end away and it's going to blow up the interior of the aircraft. Eventually he was stopped by a crew member from smoking, and he said he needed to smoke because he couldn't bear the thought of this poor lass in her coffin. That was an interesting time. Then I remember elephants. I got involved with the famous elephant, Bill Williams, the famous elephant Bill. He had an idea that we might be able to get our Bofors guns up into some parts of the jungle which were difficult to get through and get to sort of high places if we broke them up in sections and stuck them on elephants. Well, this was total dead loss. I had a fortnight with this ridiculous experiment, and all the elephants succeeded in doing. They don't like things on their back. It's not true. They don't mind dragging things, those sort of elephants, timber elephant. And so they tried to drag the barrel of the gun, which was detachable, but they dragged it as they'd drag a trunk of a tree, and they usually succeed in whacking it against other trees and bending it out of all recognition. So that experiment was abandoned. That was, you know, a useful experiment. And then I remember picking up the pieces in my... I must have been in some sort of semi-static position of the Wingate, first Wingate expedition. I seem to remember they were largely Liverpudlians or Mancunians coming through from the end of that thing, and they were pretty despondent themselves. And I remember thinking how old a lot of them looked. I mean, to me, by then, you know, a 30-year person was old. And I remember thinking, my God, these poor chaps have been slugging it through the jungle. No wonder they're so old that, you know, they're old enough to be my dad. But they weren't really that old. But I think some of the commentators have mentioned that Wingate was given, you know, a very poor battalion of not very well-trained troops for the first Chindit expedition, and a lot of them really suffered very much because physically they'd not been up to it. I remember we trying to comfort some of these chaps and patch them up a bit as they came through us. We were must have been somewhere up in the Lido area or Tinsukia or some place in far Assam. And I remember a lot about being in tea gardens very often and meeting extraordinary characters who were managers of tea gardens, usually with local wives, and very hospitable, but thoroughly soaked in whatever drink they like to soak in, and really extraordinary characters. But on the whole, I was very happy when after 3 months, my colonel, who didn't like me very much, he was a hard-bitten old Canadian from the First World War with a very bad temper, but he didn't like me and he didn't like another captain who'd come with me because we'd come as captains from Britain and he thought he should be allowed to promote all his own chaps and not have any captains pushed on him. So he got rid of the two of us because we had we both had some knowledge of combined operations, and some Indian Army order said that we were people with combined operations should be sent to this outfit that Mountbatten was raising. And so I suddenly whisked up one day and just told, pack your bags and go. You're going to a regiment which is going to do combined operations. So I went all the way back down the same old trail, slightly longer stay in Calcutta, and found myself in Bombay and loaded on a unit called the 60th Light Anti-Aircraft, which I found was a very jolly crowd and quite different. Even though they'd been out nearly as long as the 69th, they were much more well-adjusted people and were all raring to go on this new combined operations lark to recapture the Burma coast by sea.
You were saying about patching the chindits up.
Yeah.
What exactly did you mean about patching them up?
Well, these were if you look at the history of the first chindits, I can't recall the detail of it, but they got very, they were very badly cut up. I mean, they did a lot of very good work. They blew up large sections of track and the railway, and they discommoded the Japanese in northern Burma a great deal. But they didn't really do any lasting damage. A lot of the damage was showing the Japanese that they were not immune from attack, and to that extent it was considered a great success. It was on a fairly small scale. It was a sort of cut down brigade, but Wingate had very high casualties with it, and when they got out they had to sort of walk out. They had no transport of any sort, and the second Wingate expedition was able to use gliders in a much more effective way. The first one had walked in and had walked out. And by that time, they were pretty well. They'd had high casualties. They had a great deal of disease. A great deal of... I mean, the killer was malaria. Just the reason why I had not been used for the job I was sent out for, which is training Indian Army anti-aircraft gunners, was simply that the high casualties on the British units in Assam because of disease. Malaria, and then of course later on tick typhus, and there's things we hardly understood. Remember the malaria, the mepocrine, I believe, as a preventative, did not get used until must have been sometime in 42-43. All you could do was quinine if you got it. For some reason or other, which I never understood, although I was in one of the most highly malarial places, Lum Ding, which was a very wet railway junction on the Assam Railway, where something like 80% of my unit had malaria. I never got malaria once, which was considered quite extraordinary. I got some forms of dysentery, which I've still got from time to time. It lingers. It still can be reactivated, but I never got that. But that was the reason why I think there was such despondency. The sheer static life along that in the period when we were holding the Japanese and they were building up trying to invade and we were building up trying to to counter attack was a very dreadful period for all the units concerned. And the low morale and the defeat of the so-called First Arakan campaign, it's all in Slim's book, and the unfortunate General Irwin, who was thrown out of, his units were thrown out of Bengal, you know, the Arakan area. I wasn't in that area, I was up on the, you know, on the northern frontiers, but the morale really was very, very down at the time when Mountbatten came out. We were the forgotten. They did feel they were forgotten. You didn't even get any news from home. Mail was terrible. It was quite often you'd get a packet of mail, you know, anything up to a month late. You had no English newspapers. The ordinary British troop couldn't read something like the Statesman of Calcutta and get anything out of it. It was just news about India. It wasn't news about Britain. You know, with a little bit about... Everybody wanted to know what was happening in the war in Europe, of course. So it really was a dreadful time. I've learnt since, of course, that the Japanese army was equally a forgotten army in Burma, and so they had exactly the same psychosis, I think, eventually. But anyway, I went off to this unit the 60th, and my life took an upturn with that, because we had a very fine regular colonel, a man called Jenkins. The unit was being re-equipped with the good mobile artillery, and we were learning the game. They were learning the game of combined operations, and I was a troop commander again, not a wretched a quartermaster kind captain of the static unit. I was a troop commander, a very fine troop, A troop, of course the best in the regiment. And I had a lot of fun, and we went on exercises off the west coast of India and splashed around, you know, in landing craft. And I knew vaguely that my brother was doing something, the same sort of thing back in England. My life became that of a keen young artillery officer again. And there it was. We're into 1944, preparing for the assault on the seacoast of Burma with this young naval officer, Mountbatten, as the CNC, coming around and talking to us and telling us that all was going to be fine and we were going to knock the Japanese, just so we were back in Britain, they were going to knock the German. And, you know, forget all this stuff about the Forgotten Army.
Did you meet Mountbatten?
Oh, several times, yes, because he came round a lot. I mean, I didn't meet him to be presented to him at that stage. I did later, but, I mean, I met him to be enthused. And I had met him, peculiarly enough. I had met him in Scotland, or seen him in Scotland, when I was doing combined operations with the 20th. And I remember doing a night exercise there, scrambling up ropes, or scrambling down ropes, up ropes and down ropes, on the lock, and seeing this clean-cut naval officer around, and realizing after this was the great Mountbatten, or would to be the great Mountbatten. This was Lord Louis, when he was, you remember, supervising command operations.